Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Fired up to have Pat Myers, head coach at Lafayette. Fired up to have you on the show, Pat. How you doing, man?
I'm great, Jamie. Thanks for having me. Great to be back with you, man.
Yeah, buddy. It's been a long time. I remember watching you play way back in the day and probably in high school, but definitely at OSU, and kind of watch you come up through the ranks. And we've done this podcast and done a lot of stuff and talked a lot of lacrosse, but I'm very excited to have you on the show here and sort of catch up with you. So what's going on right now? It's kind of a nice time of year to basically just be able to get ready for the holidays, spend time with family and get fired up for the season, huh?
Absolutely. No doubt about it. I appreciate you, you know, mentioning that, because I do love this time of year. It's pretty quiet in here, and just looking over some notes, thinking through some different reflections and great takeaways from the convention, some great conversations that we had as a staff before we kind of broke for the holidays. There's that combination of just being juiced, being excited for what's to come, but also knowing that these next couple of weeks are, you know, great family time, great time to be, you know, with your loved ones and, you know, really fill up that cup and, you know that they're the ones that are going to be obviously supporting your journey, starting, in January. So it's a really cool time of year.
Yeah, it is. You mentioned the convention and speakers and notes. What were some of the highlights? What did you take? What have you been talking about or thinking about?
Yeah, you know, there was a lot. First of all, I'm very just encouraged and excited about the state of our game and where the IMLCA has come and how far it's come, and credit to all the leadership there and all the hard work for the people involved. But I was reflecting with my staff, you know, COVID included, I guess this is my 20th, you know, time going to convention. And I, you know, I come away every year with just, whether sometimes it's more than others, but, you know, these little nuggets that just really spark you and give you energy. You know, listening to Chris Peterson from Washington was pretty incredible, talking about building a program and culture. So there's that piece of it, to like listening to Jesse Bernhardt and guys like that, Craig Chick, Paul Richards, you know, guys talking about how to defend two-man games. That was kind of a big topic of, you know, sort of this, whether it's above the goal or below the goal, you know, different ways to go about handling two-man games, three-man games, and just continuing to realize there's so many different ways to skin a cat, and that, you know, there's no one way. And my biggest takeaway on the X and O side there, is, especially defensively, is you got to have options, is finding a way to keep it simple for your players. The challenge is keeping it simple while also having answers and options readily available based on what you're seeing and who you're seeing.
Yeah. What did Jesse say? I heard a little bit about it. I heard the playing chicken with the picker, you know, being able to make last second decisions of under and over. I really like that. I've always kind of felt like when you're playing on ball defense and there's a pick there, it's like playing one-on-one defense and dodging a pick at the same time. And you can actually like shake the pick, you know, you can sell over, sell under and go over, you know what I mean? Kind of like a double move on a split. But what were some of the takeaways on that? Cause I got some interesting things I'm thinking about on that too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think like, you know, he talks about, it's hardest thing to teach your defenders too, is just, you know, from a defensive perspective, it starts with great on ball defense and just acting like there is no pick. You know, and one thing I thought that stood out, he talked about, you know, it's great to have that early communication. We call it LED, loud, early, decisive, you know, from the guy, from the picker who's talking, hey, pick right, under.
Yeah.
But that can't have you peeking over your shoulder or deter you from, you know, playing great on ball defense. And because as good pickers, as he called it, squeeze it down and backpedal and shuffle and, you know, shrink the field, the answer to that is just, you know, we say, you know, kick and butt on ball. So if you can play good on ball defense, that's where it really all starts. And really doing a nice job there. So that was kind of, you know, it was good to hear him talk about that. And then, you know, the constant debate is, do you go back there with the picker, you know, defensively? Yeah. Is, do you want to go back there? You know, do you want to be attached or
you like it?
Yeah. You know, Jamie, kind of back to my previous comment, I think you have to have the ability to do both. You know, I think I really believe for us, the teaching starts now with being attached, you know, being more of that aggressive mindset, going back there with the picker. We certainly have rules, whether it's a big little or a little big, but I also think there's a benefit to, hey, we're just going to soften up and we're not going back there. I mean, you can't score from behind the goal. Yep. So, you know, kind of packing the paint and keeping that guy above, but there's pros and cons to both. And I think somebody put Jesse on the spot and was like, I think they were like, so are you going back there or are you not going back there? He's like, well, we want to have both. Well, if you're playing a game tomorrow, what are you doing? He's like, ah, we're going to start by going back there. So I think it's like, can you start one way and make the tweak or the adjustment based on a matchup? And that's kind of, can you keep it simple, but have that variability now? Because people are so smart, pickers are so good, and offensive coordinators are so great at making those adjustments that you got to be able to mix it up. So I think there's pros and cons to both. If you had to pick one right now, we prefer to be back there because I think it gives us more options to, if you want to double the pick, if you do want to switch it and you don't really care about matchups, it also allows you to choke or heat up. Like if you have to chip, but then not allow an easy catch, you know, to that guy, that's the challenging part about laying off the pick is now it's a really tough approach for that short stick.
Yeah. What do you like? Do you like to chip? Do you like to play defense back there where your shorty chips?
I think it depends on where the pick is being set. You know, I think Coach Hall, you know, does like to get a little chip in at times, but I also think that it can take you out of position again on that throwback to be able to, you know, choke that, or if smart guys start slipping that or ghosting that, you know, whatever the case might be, they kind of know it's coming. So I think if it's like a specific matchup, it's like, hey, we got to get this guy off his line. If it's a north south kind of like the guy's taking a straight line dodge. Yeah. So I don't think you can get into a rhythm with anything. I just think if you're chipping everything, if I'm an offensive coordinator, I see that, hey guys, we're going to set the pick here and let's slip it, that swing pick that, you know, whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. So you've been coaching little girls across, huh, Pat?
I'm trying to. I've really fallen in love with being around it, just with my two daughters and my 9-year-old's in third grade, and then my sixth grader they're both playing for Next down in Philly. You know, shout out to my wife who drives them to practice. They're also playing box. Actually taking them tomorrow night. Coach Manny, Coach Resch. Just an incredible group of coaches down there coaching up girls box, but I love it. The girls game, I mean, you know, the sticks are different, but I also think it's like really cool in terms of how fast the game is and how quick the ball comes out of their stick. So just had a ton of fun with them in the backyard, experimenting, trying different things. And as I've learned shooting space and I've learned some of these things that are very different, you know, what you can and can't do, 3 seconds on defense. It's pretty cool. It's like learning a new language, you know, it's like learning a new sport almost, but at the same time, a lot of the same skills apply. And you see some things with the girls game that you're like, no, this definitely translates. And I've just taught my daughters to play like boys in terms of how they play the game and the skills that I work on with them.
Yep. Same. I got two daughters also, a little older. I got one who graduated in 2022 and one who's a sophomore at Northwestern right now. Won the ship last year.
So cool. So,
but cool. Yeah, I love, so I tell cool. you what, I love, I can't say that I love women's lacrosse more than I love men's lacrosse, but man, I do love coaching women's lacrosse. It's so different. Such a nice changeup. Honestly, I love it because I just learn so much. It's just like I love coaching defense in men's. I love coaching offense in men's. I really love coaching anything, but so to be able to change it up allows you to learn so much. Women's lacrosse is box. I mean, it's a 7-on-7 box game. There's no poles. It's like that you can pick and move, set moving picks more freely because there actually isn't a moving pick rule. There's a block rule and a blind pick, but you can actually adjust picks right in the way of people when you want to. It's you can actually like you know in basketball the terminology touch screen where you kind of like it's like you just kind of give them a little touch and then you flip it. Yeah. You can do touch screens in lacrosse in women's lacrosse. In men's, you can't really do that. You can put your cross check on their hip nice and easy and bump them in women's lacrosse, but in men's lacrosse, you can't. And it's like I love it. There's like incredible and the passing because of the sticks is just phenomenal.
Phenomenal. I mean, you really can't, you know, the cradling, you're not bringing the stick down to your waist. You know, that's where it's different. It's not like that, really that two-handed power cradle. It's everything is up in the sphere. They call it the sphere, right? Or the bot, we call it the box. You know, everything is up nice and tight and the ball's in and out. It's 11-1 passing and, you know, the thing is moving. I mean, you bring your stick down, you're going to get it checked. You learn that pretty quickly in the girls game. Didn't you and I disagree at one point? I thought we spoke that I had mentioned to you, I think there's too many players on the field, you know, in the offensive end. I think like the 7 just seems congested to me. And you said you liked it, right?
I like it better. I think it would be too easy to score with less.
Yeah.
You know, listen, or make a smaller net, you know, but it's just too, it's, if they're already scoring, you know, 15 to 20 goals a game with 7-on-7 and like you could, it's going to be higher. The best teams are scoring 20 goals.
It's hard to play defense when with the shooting space and the, you know, things of that nature. It's challenging. It's why what Denver did last year with that.
Yeah. Their defense, their
incredible defense they had was amazing.
I'll tell you what though, the one thing I you mentioned the 11-1 thing. I think that is more of a, I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. I don't think having your stick overhand makes you a better passer. I think it makes you more predictable. I think the sticks make you a better passer because the ball comes out of regardless of the angle. I think that the changing up release points, playing with your stick lower, playing with your stick at your waist is important because it's, and I think most, and I say this only because not to contradict you, but just because I think girls are all up in a passing posture at all times. And I would really like to see them get into a dodging posture and be able to like sell dodge and be able to feed from that posture or be in a shooting posture and be able to sell shot and be able to feed or dodge from that posture. And I think it's one of the reasons, it's all constraints led approach, right? The constraint of the stick makes it easier to throw it overhand. So the ball doesn't stay in, especially with like youth sticks. You know, it's harder to play at your waist. It's harder to play, but the best girls, the best women play exactly like men and relative to their sticks. You know, Izzy Skane plays with a flatter stick. She is a little bit more 11-1. Erin Kuykendall plays with a bigger bag. She can play with a little bit more hold. So she can kind of do more angles. You know what I'm saying? But I think it's kind of similar to like men's lacrosse. When you see somebody who plays with a pretty flat stick, they might be a little more overhand than the guy with a little bit more of a pocket that can have more release points.
Yeah, no, I actually completely agree. I guess I was more talking about like in traffic, like if you get lazy with your stick with the checking rule, especially at the age that the girls are at, you can't check when the stick's up by your head. So if it's down low, you can strip the girl. You know what I mean? So it's like literally a rule thing, but I totally agree. I've been trying to teach my daughter how to throw sidearm. It's like she has a wall routine she does all the time. And a big part of her wall routine is sidearm with both hands. She actually had an indoor game yesterday. And I was so proud of her. I'm encouraging her to try new things in the game. And she split to her left hand and she dropped it down to her waist and shot sidearm left-handed. And she was like so stoked after the game, and changed angles and was able to score. And she was juiced. And I think it, to your point, you don't see as much of that maybe as you should in the women's game, but the top level girls, play with their stick all over the place, you know, lever passes and, you know, different arm angles. And I see a lot of passes get knocked down in the women's game. where girls are just matching your stick.
It's like a high five.
And it's the most frustrating thing ever, because it's like girls are staring down their pass and it gets knocked down because they're literally just matching their stick and knock it down. It happens all the time. And I'm like, no, you gotta change levels, or you gotta fake a pass to make a pass, you know, whatever the case might be.
It's so funny, but that's like that. So much of it is because they're just told to go overhand all the time. And
yeah,
like, they just overhand. And then all of a sudden they're throwing it right into someone's stick. I mean, the truth is you can't, and I don't care, it's men's lacrosse, women's lacrosse, box lacrosse, you can't throw overhand all the time. And in fact, in most playmaking situations, you're not going to, because you're going to throw it around a stick or around a body on any drawn dump. If you're really drawing somebody, you're throwing it around them. And if you're under pressure, you can't throw it overhand either. They're going to put their stick right in the way. It doesn't mean to never. Yeah. It just means that it's so funny how kids are programmed to do one thing when it's actually doesn't happen that much.
No, and you got to experiment. You got to try new things. I think with the women's game, and you know, whether it's on the wall, whether it's within, you know, 3x games or, you know, small sided games, whatever the case. I mean, the thing that has never changed and never will change is, you know, your stick work in terms of your skill level, you know, your ability to develop your skill level. And I just see such a varying degrees of like girls working on their stick work, you know, and so the girls with the best sticks are the best players, you know, whether you're athletic, you're big, fast, strong. I mean, that helps. But like, if you have a great stick, you're going to dominate in the women's game.
And is it the stick work, or is it this combination of the stick work and the decision-making?
Well, for sure, it's both. You know, the decision-making obviously is a huge piece of that, but like, you can make, I guess, like better decisions. You have the ability to choose option B or C if your stick is legit. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, the IQ piece and learning the game. And I try to watch it a lot as much as I can. With there's so much on TV now. I mean, all these women's games on ESPN Plus, and I just love watching these high level games and seeing how these girls operate and different moves that they make. And it's just actually, I had an opportunity to take the girls over to USA Box training camp this weekend in Whitehall.
Oh, did you go? My daughter was there.
No way. Yeah, we went over on Saturday and watched them scrimmage to a group of men. And it was in Charlotte and all these girls. It was so cool.
My daughter Lucy was on Charlotte's team.
Is that right? No way, man. That's a, what number was she? I watched her play.
She scored a couple goals, actually.
Did she really? That's so cool. I was super impressed with the level of play. But watching them play with those sticks, some of them had never touched a boy stick.
How much do you have your daughters play with boy sticks?
A fair amount, because they're playing box. Yep. So that obviously you know, puts that in their hand. But honestly, they probably could do it more. I think experimenting with a boy stick allows you to just see what you're capable of doing, you know, with a stick in your hand. I've heard Gary Gate talk about that, you know, in terms of girls don't use boy sticks, but when you pick up that stick, it's like, oh, this is so cool, I can do this. But it's like, you can actually do that with a girl stick too.
Exactly.
They just don't know what those limitations are at times until they pick up the boy stick.
Totally. Honestly, I think it's so important. My daughter played with a boy stick a lot because we played so much 3x. And with a tennis ball, you might as well play with a boy stick, because it's not really giving you that realistic look with a girl stick and a tennis ball. I mean, you can do it and it's good practice for your hands, but you're not going to get the same hold that will allow you to do an experiment with all those release points and fakes that you were talking about. And so by playing with a boy stick, it basically, a boy stick and a tennis ball is pretty comparable to a girl stick and a lacrosse ball in terms of what you can do. But the girl stick and lacrosse ball, you may never try it. With a boy stick, you definitely will. Why do you think every single boy like shoots underhand all the time and most girls don't? It's their stick. It's not like a boy-girl thing. It's not a gender thing. It's purely the fact that their stick allows them to do it. And so they do. And it just kind of gives a huge advantage, I think.
I agree. What do you think of the length of girls' sticks? Like, I had a long conversation with Paul Carcaterra about this. It's just grill sticks are longer. And he was like, oh, you know, my, and his daughter is unbelievable. You know, if you've ever seen her play, she's ridiculous. And he's like, no, she plays with a 40-inch stick. She's like, if Michael Sowers and these guys are playing with 40-inch sticks, why shouldn't an attacker on the girl side? And I thought it was a great point, you know, because it allows them to handle their stick a little better. I know you want length in girls so you can do high grabs and, you know, go up and get the ball. But a lot of girls, I think, are playing with sticks that are too big, especially at the younger levels.
I mean, do you know what the minimum length is? It's not 40. It's not 38. It's 35 and a half. I'd say my daughter Lucy probably plays with a rep between 36 and 37 inch stick most of the time.
She plays with a 36 or 37?
36, 37, 38, in that range, way well below 40. I don't know where it is right now, but I know that she's experimented with that.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it makes your stick quicker. You just can't get checked. Now, if you're like on a draw circle, it's just like any positional thing. If you need to have a longer stick because of what you're doing and your role in the game, then you do that. But when your role in the game is scoring goals and being able to have, you know, quicker hands, quicker release, I mean, a shorter stick is a quicker stick. It's kind of like, honestly, in men's lacrosse, it's the same thing with defensemen. You know, like everyone, like it's a one size fits all. Let's just get a 6 foot stick. I don't care if you're 10 years old or if you're 20, 21 years old, but you know, everyone just uses the same length. But you know, chopping length off of a stick in men's lacrosse off a pole makes a massive difference. Now, not everyone needs it because some people are 6'5". You know, but you listen to Brody Merrill talk about he grew up playing with a stick up to like his, you know, V-neck, you know, like he played with a shorter stick and he was tall. And why? Because he's a box guy. Lachelle Harris, same thing. Remember Lachelle Harris? You know who he is, the Archers, but he also like was a defenseman and he played with a stick that was, below his chin. And his stick work, his ability to be strong with a check, his ability to knock down passes, obviously getting the ball off the ground, holds, trail checks. It's interesting. You know, you go with a little bit of a shorter stick and your trail check is so much quicker. It takes attackmen by surprise. They're not used to having someone check them that quick.
You really don't see anybody doing that.
You don't. Torp probably. He was at that in Denver. We cut a fist off of pretty much every guy's stick. You know, it's pretty funny. When I was coaching 6 years ago, I was coaching with the Atlanta Blaze. I was the defense coordinator with Dave Huntley. And R.I.P. Hunts, he died 6 years ago today, actually.
Yeah, amen.
Yep. And anyways, I was coaching Scott Ratliff. And Scott was obviously an elite LSM, undersized guy. Great motor, great athleticism, incredible hands. And I was like, Rad, have you ever thought about chopping your stick down a little? I was like, look at Brody Merrill. I mean, his stick goes up to his chin, you know, but he's 6'4", 6'5". You know, you're like 5'10", 5'11", and your stick's over your head. And he's like, no, I never really thought about it, but maybe I'll try it out. And he chopped like a tiny little bit. He's like, I kind of like it. And every week he chopped a little bit more and a little bit more. And that, he sent me a text at, you know, that tournament they play in Maui?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that like pro tournament in Hawaii or whatever. Yep. He texted me after. He's like, Coach, I thought you'd like to know. I chopped 10 inches off my stick and I was MVP of the tournament.
That's hilarious.
It is. I'll tell you right now, it's really interesting because it's like, okay, what do you lose from having a few inches off your stick? You know, like, well, you lose your ability to cover it. It's like, I don't know. It's like, just hold your hand in front of you and then slide it 3 inches. And see like how much you actually lost, you know, right. What you gain though. It's kind of like if you play with a golf club that's too long, what you gain in terms of being able to like move your stick faster and be stronger with more leverage. I mean, the defensive game now is so much about holding. You got to be able to be strong with holding. You got to hold the crap out of people in terms of recovering. That's what a trail check is. You'd rather not have to like use your trail check, but you're gonna have to because people are gonna beat you and you gotta do something while someone's sliding to try to get your stick on something. Not to mention knocking down balls, you know. I mean, your ability to move your stick faster is just it's not an arguable point. And so figuring out the balance of how much is really kind of the discussion, in my opinion. And if you're already 6'5", maybe you don't really need to, you're already moving that fast. But not everyone, you know. the same guy who's a freshman in college might be different than who's a senior in terms of how strong they are. I mean, kids come in as freshmen, they're still comp kids. Once you're a man, you know, you can move that thing.
Nuts. You make a lot of great points there.
Hey, let's talk a little offense. Tell me something that you're thinking about, that you're excited about, whether you're doing it or thinking about it or a new drill, anything. I'm just curious to hear where your head's at on that.
Yeah. Offensively, you know, we have spent the last, you know, few years, 2-3 years really, sort of developing, you know, what we call the NBA offense, which is more of a principles-based offense. And, you know, a lot of people are running it, 2-man side, 3-man side, you know, a guy at X. But really being able to have the right mix of, you know, kind of your traditional motion with, you know, that style of offense. And I think that's kind of where the magic is made, is it's not a one size fits all in terms of your personnel. And so as you bring in, you know, new personnel and different personnel and blending them with the guys that you have of really, you know, putting your kids in the right positions to succeed and having a couple of different answers, you know, for your own personnel versus, hey, look, this is how the coverage that we're getting from the defense. And so that's, to me, the fun part. And, you know, who's playing attack, who's playing midfield is certainly part of it. You know, creating sort of that positionless mentality. But one of the things we've concentrated a little bit more on is kind of like they talk in basketball, the word gravity, you know, of, you know, do you want your Dodgers at attack? Do you want your Dodgers at midfield? I mean, ideally you have, you know, multiple Dodgers on the field at one time in different roles for different guys. But, you know, if you take your best Dodger, you know, do you want him on the field for every single possession? Of course you do, but maybe he's not suited perfectly to be an attackman. But I think the type of, you know, gravity that you can create with your 2-man games and swinging the ball from one side of the field to the other, to switch it up and then, you know, really open up some opportunities for maybe other guys that need a little bit of a leverage, maybe aren't like the spark initiator guys. You know, that's the fun part, I think, for us as coaches, with these guys kind of blending all these styles together, and really creating the best possible, most efficient offense that we can with the guys that we have. Some guys just want to get, we want to get them the ball out of the box and let them, you know, be a straight line Dodger, and they're not going to fit into the NBA, you know, style offense. And so I think blending those two things has been kind of where our focus has been, and just finding the right fit for our personnel so that we can really maximize every single possession. The early offense piece, I think, Jamie's kind of the other hot button, is just like,
what, you know, early offense? What'd you say? Early offense?
Yeah. Early offense. Yeah. So we actually kind of refer to it as grubbing. Green is kind of our quick strike, run with three, get vertical, whereas then you have like that sub phase. And so kind of being able to blend those two phases together is what we call grub. And the magic there of, you know, situational lacrosse and, you know, letting your players play fast, but then seamlessly flowing into, you know, your offensive set, before the shot clock's down at, you know, 30. And so I think, you know, giving yourselves 40 to 50 on the clock is ideal. So those are kind of the two things that we're focused on. You know, I would say, offensively, how quickly can we, get into our offense, but we want to take advantage of kind of that early phase, as much as we can. So, those are some of the things that we've spent most of our fall, kind of working on.
Oh, you want to hear a cool idea on a early offense sub game idea?
Hit me with it.
You know what a get is in basketball?
I don't.
A get, you've seen it. A get is kind of like dribble handoff, but it's before you start dribbling. So it's where like if you threw the ball to me and I threw it right back to you, and then I used you as a pick while you're going to decide to hand it to me or not.
Okay. Got it. Yeah.
So that's like, it's basically like having the ball and being a pick, but I was thinking about doing that in sub game. Basically you get a shorty, you get someone you're going to try to run off, and then you just get in the way of the defender with the ball. You could probably blow somebody up, honestly, if you caught him by surprise, but you could run him right off. and you're going to get yourself a big advantage. And you may say, well, you know, they might double you, but if you got a pretty good athlete, they're probably not going to allow themselves to get doubled, and you can probably create offense out of it. But what do you think about the get sub game idea?
No, I like it. I think your point on like they might double you is just like you're kind of just creating chaos.
Totally,
you know, you're just creating an uncomfortable position for
you. All you gotta do is get out of it, and you're gonna probably have a great smart chase.
You're gonna get doubled, and then the guy's gonna decide to get off, and you're gonna be man up for 5 seconds while the defense is scrambling. You know, and I think you make a great point. You just, if you want to do stuff like that, and it's a great idea, you got to practice it. And as a coach, you got to just let it go. You got to be comfortable, obviously, just allowing those things to unfold. Kind of back to my previous point about, you know, having your best players on the field at attack, you know, as much as you possibly can, so that, you know, the ball's in their stick as much as possible, and letting them, you know, make decisions.
Yeah. So you were talking earlier about two-man side, three-man side. I mean, so how much would you say, what percentage, if you could throw a percentage on it, just doesn't have to be perfect, but would you say you guys attack with two-man games versus one-on-one?
Well, that's an interesting question because, you know, I kind of, one of the ways we teach the two-man game is like make it a one-on-one, you know?
That's what it is. That's what people don't realize. It is a one-on-one. You have to dodge unpredictably like it's a one-on-one, or it's way too easy for the defense, right?
Yeah, which also is the crux of that is that's how you become a great picker, is you realize that the dodger is going one-on-one. And so he's going to be unpredictable. He might hezzy. He might echo. He might step away and re-dodge. But like you're reading kind of the defender's path to the goal. And okay, he beat his guy, he doesn't even need the pick now. You know, I think part of a great two-man game is knowing when to not set the pick, you know, is like not being a robot and going out there and just setting a hard pick. And it's like the guy already beat his guy. Now you just created, you know, a switch when you could have, you know, slipped it. And so I think, but to your question, it's honestly a one in the same.
I agree. Totally.
In terms of the one-on-one versus, you know, the two-man game. So I would say we're constantly in two-man games, like, you know, most of the time, in terms of, okay, is the two-man game just a guy popping behind the ball? You know, is he a guy that's clearing through, or is he actually engaging in a pick? And I think people think of that two-man game of just a pick, you know, and it's really a lot more than that. Sometimes just a great clear through, a flyby, you know, something of that nature.
Yeah,
but we're always working in tandem, in pairs, to some degree. It might not look like your traditional, what you think of pairs offense, but you've always got a partner, whether or not that guy decides to engage and, you know, go hunt the back of somebody's jersey is a different story. And I think one of our points of pride that I think gets lost is, you know, the KYP of knowing your own personnel. You know, something I learned a long time ago at Cornell with Coach Tambo is one of the first things that really stuck with me of like, we got to know ourselves better than we know anybody else. Like people want to jump to, okay, what coverage are we getting here? But if I'm playing with you, I know you're left-handed and I know you like this move, and I'm reading your body language. You know what I mean? Like I'm reading you, and that chemistry is far greater than can handle any defensive coverage. And I think that's the key. Like, I know you're going to split, and you know, when you split, you like to come back to your strong hand here. And so I might set my pickup, and as soon as you roll back and I see the back of your helmet, I'm going to get out of there and try to get two defenders on the same side, so that now, you know, you might give me a look back fake, and now you're getting now all of a sudden the defense is frozen and you're in the middle of the field at 12 yards. I think those are kind of the things that.
Yeah, I agree, man. And I think like communication falls into the KYP. I mean, as just as important as kind of knowing what you think people are going to do, it's like communicating with your teammates before the play, after play, in the middle of the play, to make sure that we know like what the next steps are going to be, because there's so many variables and so many options. But can you talk a little bit about how you emphasize communication in two-man game on and off ball, and how you guys sort of think about that?
Yeah. I mean, we have obviously calls for like, you know, two man game, menu options. You know, I think, same thing with the off ball stuff. You know, we just try to utilize film to show guys what the options are and let them decide, okay, am I going to seal? Am I going to slip? I'm talking off ball now.
Yep.
You know, can I create some contact with my defender? You know, can I pin this guy? Are they really heavy? Are they, you know, talking, going back to our original kind of conversation about how to defend this, you know, there's multiple ways. Like, are you going to, you know, what we call DC designated, you know, slider from the backside, or are you going to come off the two man game? You know,
yeah.
So that's the first thing that I would want our offense to read is, are they coming off the two man game? Are they coming off the backside? You know, how are they playing it? And then according to that, we can take advantage of that. I think offensively. So if we know they're coming off the two man game, we obviously want to set it tighter to the goal. If we can, you know, in terms of where that point of contact is, I think the nonverbal communication, Jamie, I guess I don't know if I'm answering your question, is probably more important than the actual verbal, you know? So I'm giving you body language cues. If I'm going to come out and work with you, it's a head nod, it's eye contact. It might even be just, you know, pointing. And I think the same thing, you know, off ball, in terms of that nonverbal, changing speeds, dodging into your cut, dodging into your pick. The same way you dodge is the same way you need to set yourself up for your pick and for your off ball action, with that same sense of, like, you know, change of speed, change of direction, all those sort of things. So to me, it's more just reps in practice. Yes, there's skill cues and there's certain calls, but it's more that nonverbal to me in terms of, okay, this is the coverage we're getting. This is the person I'm working with. Let's do it.
Yeah. I kind of feel like off ball, there's a little bit more room for just general, you know, like, hey, I'm sealing for you, or seal for me. Come over to the top. You know, I'm sealing for you. So that somebody kind of knows. Now, obviously, if you're playing with people enough, you don't have to communicate like that, but it's part of the process. So you don't get to nonverbal communication without having played a lot, which you just said, and actually kind of been communicated about it. One of the things too, is how much do you guys repick much?
Yeah. I mean, I think like the pick and the repick is a really nice tactic. I think, you know, some of that depends on, you know, again, who's involved in the two man game. And we don't necessarily, and I'm not sure if this is your question, so go into it saying that we want to repick. You know, it's obviously we want to set a quality, we're going into it. We want to try to set a quality pick. But a lot of times, if that doesn't work out, that second action, whether it's now you're swinging back around and, you know, you're setting it up. And I think the softer the defense plays you on ball, they're kind of opening themselves up to, okay, we're creeping in, we're squeezing down. Back to Coach Bernhardt's discussion, you know, pick, repick. Next thing you know, you're coming off that pick with your hands free, and putting yourself in a pretty good spot.
Yeah. I think a repick is something that is, you know, it's just generally harder for the defense to cover two actions in a row. They feel like they're good, and then all of a sudden you come right back on them and they're not ready for it. I don't think you should, it takes a little while, and I don't think it's perfect for every situation, but I think it's a really good mix in. But I also was going to say, I think there's the communication on repicks is important, because if the Dodger doesn't know the picker's coming back or vice versa, you're not going to get a repick. And so, I just feel
or
like
you're gonna get a moving pick.
What's that?
Or you're going to get a moving pick.
Yeah. You might,
you know,
but you know, a lot of times you'll just see like repicks happen through the KYP when it's like, I'm a lefty, you pass down, pick down to me. I split like I'm not using it. And you just follow me right down, 'cause you know, there's a good chance I'm coming back anyways. And that's like,
yes.
You know, that's something you don't have to call out. The one that you would have to call out is like, I'm up top, you're up picking for me, and I really want to dodge from the wing. So I'm going to be like, you know, we communicate repick, you slip to the middle, I take it down the wing, I step back, you come back, and all of a sudden we've created a nice gap. You know, those types of ones require maybe a little bit more communication and stuff like that. But yeah, it's really cool. So how much do you pick long to short versus short to long? Will you pick long to short?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, we will pick long to short. I think
so everybody's got to be able to do this.
Yeah, everyone's got to be able to do.
I mean, for the most part, it sounds like in your offense, you're like, well, you know, sometimes we have some downhill guys, you know, that don't fit into that. But it seems more like you're way better off fitting into everything and then having the ability to go downhill and not do it than the other way around. Like, you want to be able to fit into that.
Honestly, I think that's what the fun part. Yeah, to answer your question, yes, but I think the fun part is like guys having different, you know, different skill sets, and then as a coach being able to plug that in and say, okay, can we start with a turbo dodge, a straight line dodge, and then roll into our NBA offense versus maybe, you know, trying to sustain that for a more extended period of time if you have, you know, guys out there that maybe aren't great at that. And I think also showing the defense different looks, you know, okay, this midfield is maybe more of a big little midfield, and you know, this midfield is more of, you know, a downhill or even an NBA offense. In your tack, you need to be able to do it all. You know, you need to be able to manage that. And back to your communication piece, it takes one person, in my opinion, that is an elite communicator. Yeah. And I think, like, you know, even like you looked at, you know, Scott Beto, who's doing a great job, you know, out at Michigan, and, you know, watching his talk and Mikey Baim and how he, you know, basically runs the show for them, you know. And back when I was at Carolina, Marcus Holman was that guy. You know, it takes one guy that is like that elite communicator that gets everybody on the same page.
So really true, man. Well, because you know what? The bottom line is that if you don't have, I mean, it's great if everybody knows their personnel and everybody knows what they're doing. But the deal is that there's people out there on every play that aren't sure about what to do at a certain moment in time. And if you have somebody that can help you, it's like, bang, I can go do that. I just need someone to help me out. Those guys make people so much better by reminding them what we're doing and what the situation is and what the defense is doing. And then they can go execute.
It's hard to put a price tag on it, honestly, either like where it takes your offense in terms of its efficiency and its functionality. And the last point I want to make on that is just that if it's your best player, then you've struck gold.
Yeah, exactly.
If your best communicator is your best player, then you're really, really onto something, because that is really special. One drill we do on the two-man games that we've really enjoyed is the 2v2 into a 3v2, and we do it from four different spots. So it's to work on the short long and the long short. We kind of sprinkle the short sticks defensively, but we'll go from behind both wings and up top. And basically it's a live 2-on-2. And whatever two-man action you want, pick, repick. The guys on the side aren't allowed to cross the middle of the field. But once they basically threaten the middle of the field, the middle guy steps out and says, hey, double, double, double. They roll, spin pass, throw back, chin to shoulder, roll back, whatever, hit that guy. And now it's a live 3-on-2 to the goal. And we go.
Wait, so it's basically live 3-on-2. 3-0-2-D or 3-D?
Yeah, 3-0-2-D. So it's a 2-v-2, and then there's 3-0 lines, and that middle – so the middle line has a ball and a stick. He kicks it out to one of the two offensive guys on the side, and they go into a two-man game, and they go basically like an 80% 2-v-2, over, under, defensively, what have you. Yep. And as soon as they kind of like threaten the middle of the field or the defense has played one or two picks, we kick it back to that middle guy who's now coming full speed. Defense is a little bit out of position to play the 3-v-2. And they've got to drop in and communicate. And then we go up top, middle, other wing, and behind. I think that top area is like an underutilized area to set picks. So like basically you're coming over the top. Maybe you're coming out of the box and the guy is picking maybe like right at the top of the box, but like on a post, basically kind of in that like post area or that pocket area where defenses really have to make a decision on, am I going over this? Am I going under this? Are we switching this? And it's out front of the goal. Which
and it's hard to know who's sliding, because if there's two inside, especially, it's like you haven't established a strong side, you know?
So we work on that area of the field a lot. We call that a rifle pick. And, you know, I think if you put the defense in a position where, to your point, do you pick short, long, well, or long, short? If you put your best player right up there.
Yeah, I know. They don't want
to. And you got a nice short stick with speed. Here's your turbo guy, your straight line guy, kind of marrying that principle of, okay, this guy, maybe he's not a great like NBA guy, but he's a good straight line guy. And he's coming off that rifle pick. Like, are you switching that? Are you getting under that? It's a great way to enter your NBA offense.
Yeah, I love it. You know what? I was thinking about that scenario actually just recently. And I was actually talking with Mike Sowers about this. But I think, you know what snake dribble looks like? You know what that concept is in basketball?
I'm sorry, what was it?
Snake dribble. Ever heard of that?
Snake dribble.
Yeah. It's kind of like hostage dribble, but it's like when you get somebody on your back in a drop coverage, they're
dropping. I was going to say, is it a hostage dribble where you like,
kind of like that, but it's not slow. It's more like when you see the guy, when you see like Chris Paul come over the pick with speed and he S dodges right around where the
hell,
instead of running, you know what I'm saying? It basically turned the scenario that you just talked about with control into like an S dodge where they don't know which way you're going. It always happens out top in the NBA. And I was thinking about this in lacrosse, that it would be actually really sick if you could bring somebody over a pick like that under control, but be fast enough to be able to sort of go left or right and S dodge right around the guys. And I think that's like a
really, yeah. I mean, if they're like determined to take away your strong hand and they're just sitting on that,
you're pretty two handed, you know, you come over that.
You get a two-handed dodger that you know is going to have a short stick on him, and you can – that's that gravity concept too of, like, your best player is going to have gravity to him. You know what I mean? In terms of they don't necessarily want to leave him. You know, there's, like, a gravitational pull there that you can create an offense, I think, off of that. I also think the – you know, I love the low wings. I love the mid wings. I know everybody wants to dodge the wings these days. I think we'd call the 400, but the top center spot, like, is one of the most, like, underutilized, I think, dodging spots in lacrosse, and one of the hardest to defend. And I'm putting my defensive
especially when
hat
you
on.
Roll back.
Yeah, I mean, if you're
you
up there,
roll back up there. I mean, dodging from the middle is one thing, and it's great. But when all of a sudden you, like, start drawing slides and you roll back on that, and you roll back on both guys, and then you get two people, it's almost like you can hang up two people, and you got adjacents hung up too. I mean, it's like it actually really hangs up more, almost like doubles the amount of sliders that are kind of hung up with your dodge.
Yeah, there's a lot of decisions to make defensively on how you want to play. Do you want to go out and play the guy? Do you want to drop off and play it soft? You know, they're just it's a pain. For sure. So, and we rep those two-man games kind of from all those different spots.
Do you
that's one of our favorite drills.
Do you ever get into that middle action out of, like, weave actions where all of a sudden you kind of, like, don't have it and then you just start rolling back in the middle of the field and just see what happens? Do you give your guys – I remember Yale did a great job of doing that a couple of years ago. They were excellent at that. In Virginia, interestingly enough – you know, because they double people's backs a lot, they actually, like, were kind of ready to play against that. But that's almost what you have to do when people start rolling back in the middle of the field, is be able to jump on them a little bit.
Yeah, you make a great point. It's something we've talked about defensively, is at a certain point on the field, do you just encourage that? You know, that you're talking about sliding to somebody's back of somebody's helmet, right? On like on a rollback. I think the art of sliding to a rollback, those, like, you know, it's the difference of, like, you know, we have to go versus, like, you know, you want to go to that and create, you know, a turnover. Loyola is really good at that. At times, you know, we'll encourage you to dodge to the middle of the field. And you're like, oh, I've got to step on my guy, you know, and then the next thing you know, they're coming to the back of your helmet. So we've seen other teams do that really well. It's an area certainly we need to be, we can improve on defensively, but I think that's an area that, you see more and more of, you know, and defensively being able to take some chances and take some risks, I think, is, like, you got to live in that space a little bit defensively now, because offenses are really good. You know, are you going to, you know, clamp some picks below the goal line? Are you going to, you know, encourage the rollback and slide maybe, you know, and try to put the ball on the ground? You know, I think if it's just a tug of war all the time on every single possession, you know, in terms of, hey, we're not going to make a mistake. I think you got to be a little bit more up on your toes and play a little more aggressive defense. That's my opinion.
I agree. And I also think with how much more I sort of alluded to this earlier, but with how much holding is going on defensively, you know, what does a hold set up? Well, it sets up a double. You trap guys.
Yeah.
You know, whether
you're talking about, like, the seatbelt, like a shorty, like getting
under the armpit, with longs, with, like, the crowbar, with reverse V holes, with regular V holes. I mean, you know, like, what, you know, Notre Dame has been V holding forever. And one of the reasons is they can capture you in there and get you stuck, because it's a hold, and it's a hold, you know, holding is a penalty, but you're allowed to hold to a certain degree. It's kind of funny. I wonder, like, how everybody feels about how much holding is going on. But then again, there's a lot of goals being scored, so I think that there should be no rule changes as it relates to letting people use their sticks to hold. You know, if you're scoring 15 goals, you know, in big games, you know, it's probably, you know, a lot of goals anyways. But I just feel like the whole idea, you see this in the PLL, just it seems like so much of what they're trying to do is not go. They want to double. They want to hold the crap out of you so they can. And I look at the people that are whacking and I see them giving up separation of their stick from the body. And I see people that are holding, that are giving themselves a chance of A, ball pressure, and B, double teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you've seen more of that. I think it's called fairly appropriately. I don't think there's too much of it. I have seen
there's more of it though. The shorties are doing it a lot more, you know, between the
crowbar. Yeah, I think they're better trained.
The seatbelt doesn't.
They're better trained.
I don't think it should.
It's a position that is very well coached now. The short stick position, you're seeing like, you know, really good guys that are being, you know, asked to play short stick defense, and it's a position that's recruited. You see a lot more trail checking now too, I think, from short sticks. I think that's not kind of back to that back of the head mentality of, you know, when you get down to that kind of low area on the field, we call it the Bermuda Triangle, kind of like no man's land, where it's like, are we going to this? Are we not going to this? And making that decision. But I think short sticks being savvy with that trail check, definitely seeing a lot more of that.
Well, especially because you're doing it usually when you got help there. You know, you're not just doing it far out. You're doing it in this no man's land because it's actually like, we're going to have to go. We might as well like get ball pressure while we're going. You know, you're tight enough to do it.
Absolutely.
You know, and same thing on picks. I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been watching I did a podcast with Jack Rowlett a few weeks ago, and I love watching that guy play. And I kind of look at where, you know, people think he's like, you know, takes chances on stuff, but he's very calculated with it. Like when he's going over somebody's head, a lot of time it's because he's going over a pick. He knows he's kind of not getting there. He knows the defender, his help is right there. He's going to go right over his head when he goes over the pick. Like, why wouldn't you? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, you got it. You got a guy sitting there going to chip or show or double or help, whatever. But I think it's the same concept though, as trail checking in no man's land. You've got help. You're not doing it without help, because if you do, you're going to give them a window.
Absolutely.
Better off doing it because you're not getting out of there early enough to cover people up anyways. So you might as well, like, you know, give yourself a chance for a turnover, make them run away so that you can recover back in and get back to neutral.
Yeah, I think that's why Jack's one of the best defenders in the world. You know, he's on the world team. It's the combination of the decision, back to your original point on, you know, the decision making combined with, you know, elite, obviously, athleticism and stick work, and, you know, kind of marrying those two things together. I think he talked about how he's made adjustments in on your podcast. He's made adjustments in the PLL from how he approaches people, how he defends people now. He was getting beat on inside rolls and, you know,
just trying kind to of turn guys stuff. And realize you can't do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, just that thought process, I think is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is really cool. So, Pat, when we were sort of chatting a little bit before we got on, you were talking about an interesting topic that I've never spoken about on this podcast before, but it was sort of the mental health of coaches. I mean, I know that when I was a head coach, I was so like immersed and so like there was times when all I wanted to do was be in the office. I didn't really want to be on vacation. I just wanted to work. I just wanted to go recruit. I wanted to watch film. Sounds terrible, but it's just what happens sometimes when you get really into what you're doing. And I was curious about your sort of thoughts on that, about how you find a work-life balance and still be able to like feel really good about being a hard worker.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question. Jamie, you make a lot of good points. I mean, it's very easy to become consumed by this profession, and, you know, work-life balance is honestly a bit of a myth, you know, from a standpoint of like, you're going to be spending more time. There are sacrifices. You're going to be spending more time here. I tell, you know, when we talk to parents and go through the recruiting process with these young men, you know, and it's just the reality. I say, I'm going to spend more time with your son than I probably will with my own daughters. When you're talking about day to day, I mean, I'm with them, you know, from the start of the day to the end of the day. And, you know, I think as coaches, it's easy to become, so hyper focused on, the mission, the task at hand, serving, the young men in your locker room, your staff. And we spend a lot of time talking about mental health, and rightfully so, of the student athletes. I personally don't think we spend enough time talking about the mental health of the people that are supposed to be emptying their cup for the student athletes, every single day. And how do you keep your cup? Because the reality is you can't serve them unless your cup is full.
It's so true, man.
And if you're running on empty all the time, or even, a low tank, you're not going to be at your best. And I've certainly made the mistake as a young, younger coach in my assistant days of just like you. I mean, being on vacation, it's like you're not really on vacation. Your mind's somewhere else. Yep. You want to be watching video. You're thinking about this and thinking about that. And as my girls have gotten older, and as becoming a head coach, I think is where I've really, and understanding more how our guys work and what makes them tick, and going through COVID and the importance of mental health for them. And, we talk about lacrosse is what you do. It's not who you are. Having a greater purpose, both as a coach, but, helping your players, I think, find their why, is a big part of my own purpose and my own why, and helping them understand that they are so much more than lacrosse players. And I think, and again, to have those conversations, to be at your best, to be a great leader, to help them understand those things and work through that, and lead those conversations, you have to be walking the walk. I just think about, my daughters and my wife and the sacrifices they've made for me and my journey. And I've really just tried to take a step back these last couple of years and do a better job of, just working out every day. Yeah. I mean, like, the reality is, like, we all skip workouts. I got this to do. I've got that to do. I've got to get to my email inbox. And if I can give any piece of advice, I was down at convention listening to young head coaches talking about, what pieces of advice they would have for assistants, and they did a phenomenal job. But if I could give any piece of advice, it would be work out every day. There's nothing more important than just, going for a run. Your to-do list is never going to be empty. All right. You're never going to have everything checked off the list. It's never going anywhere. So you might as well take care of yourself, take care of your body, and really in turn, take care of your mind. So you can be the best leader you can be. I have a lot of work to do and a long way to go. I'm certainly a work in progress there, but I can tell you now more than ever that my daughters are a priority. I missed some recruiting this November. I told the staff, I said, listen, like, I'm going to help out with my daughter's club team this November. I'm going to go on the road one day, and then the other day I'm going to coach her team. And man, I had a blast and I have zero regrets. You know what, Jamie, we still got some, in my opinion, I think we still landed some good recruits and got out and saw the guys we needed to see. And yeah, I was able to coach my daughter at the same time. So
I love it. I remember when I was a young head coach, I remember distinctly sitting in the bathroom, bathing my kids, washing their hair, thinking about my incoming recruiting class and being like, you're such an asshole to not be present for this right now. But mindfulness, man, that's something that I've been trying to learn a lot about. And I think if there was a couple things that I would say that if I were a head coach again, I'd like to make sure I did, was practice more mindfulness and not let things bother me. Number one, don't let, if something bothers you, it's on you. There could be issues with that person that you got to deal with, but if it's bothering you though, that's not really on them. That's internal. And then the second thing is sleep. I feel like I deprive myself of sleep to try to outwork everybody. And when I get tired, I'm definitely not as good at anything.
No, the sleep thing is huge, man. And we all struggle with it. You're it's a blessing and a curse, Jamie, what you just talked about in terms of like being with your kids, right? It's also what makes you special. It's also what makes you great. It's one of your passion, your energy. It's why you've had so much success in this business, in this profession. So, I think it's just being mindful of that, of knowing like kind of yourself and what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are. And, I think that anything, done too much can become a strength, can become a weakness if you're not careful. So I think that's where I've just been, being smarter as a coach. You make a great point on letting things go and During COVID, we started a practice here of gratitude. Before every practice, we take a knee together as a group, and guys just share what's on their heart, things that they're grateful for. Because we know it's impossible to be grateful and unhappy at the same time. So, you know, I'm kind of leaving behind all the stresses, the classroom, like whatever is on their mind. But hey, this is what I'm grateful for today. I'm just excited to be here at practice and be with my brothers. And I'm grateful for, you know, our trainer, my parents, my teacher, whatever is on their heart that day, I think is an opportunity to really lean into each other. So gratitude has become a really big part of our program. And just to your point, being where your feet are, you know, not, you know, comparing yourself to others, but just, hey, listen, let's make what we have great. Let's make this special. And that's kind of how we built this program, honestly, you know, from day one. And I'm really excited to keep that going and know that I need to continue to grow as a leader.
Yeah, man. I love it, Pat. Thanks for taking some time and talking lacrosse. This was maybe one of the most diverse conversations on a podcast I've ever had. We touched on a lot of stuff, but it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I appreciate you allowing it to go a few different directions. And, you know, I'm grateful to be on here with you. I listen to all the, you know, all the podcasts you do. I know the coaches around the country appreciate it. We've all learned a lot from each other because of this outlet. So just thanks to you and for this platform. And I'm grateful, James. Thanks.
Awesome, man. Thanks, Pat. Have a great holiday, man. We'll be in touch.
Happy holidays.